You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, you guys. As an avid reader, I love to learn new things, to gain insight into books and characters that fascinate me, and to better appreciate the world as it is. That's why I love The Great Courses Plus. It's a streaming learning service that offers in-depth, reliable information on just about anything I'm interested in, from literature to history to science to psychology to cooking to learning a new language, you name it. This is unlimited access to thousands of topics presented by renowned experts who are passionate about what they teach. And it's user-friendly. You can watch or listen on your clock whenever you want from anywhere. Lately, I've been enjoying a course called Stories About Great Storytellers, which makes sense since I talk to people who tell stories on this podcast. I was just listening to one about A.A. Milne, the guy who invented Winnie the Pooh. When did he come up with Winnie the Pooh? I just found out. I know the answer. Do you? There is so much to discover on The Great Courses Plus. I know you're going to love it. And to help you get started, they are offering other people, listeners, a special limited time offer. A full month of unlimited access to the entire library for free. It's free. Sign up through my special URL today and start enjoying your free month of The Great Courses Plus. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/otherppl. That is thegreatcoursesplus.com/otherppl. Okay? All right.
You are not alone. You have found other people.
You and I have a friend in common.
Every stupid thing that a writer could do, I've done.
I think it's really beautiful.
Jeez, what a struggle, you know?
It was incredible. You know, it was like your head exploded seeing what was really there.
And now here's your host, Brad Listing.
Just one person at just one time.
Hey, everybody. Right. How's it going? Right. Welcome to the Other People Podcast. I am Brad Listy. And I'm in Los Angeles, California. This is a special Sunday edition of the Other People Podcast. What do you think about that? I have Peter Stenson on the program. His novel, 37, is available now from DeZank Books. It is the official February pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. TheNervousBreakdown.com is my online culture magazine and literary community. It has its own monthly book club. If you want to find out more about that, go to thenervousbreakdown.com. I should also add that thenervousbreakdown.com has a new or a relatively new editor-in-chief. Joseph Grantham, a past guest on this program, is now the editor-in-chief of The Nervous Breakdown. If you would like to submit something to The Nervous Breakdown, his email is jgrantham@thenervousbreakdown.com. Fiction, poetry, essays, what have you. It's like a lit site. It's got some good stuff up there. You should check it out. And it's got a book club. And I interviewed the authors from the book club on this podcast. Oh. I don't know what to tell you. I was sick earlier this week. I had the flu, but it was a quick flu. It was like a, you know, 2-3 days. I processed it. I was supposed to go to this monster truck rally with my kids last Sunday. And then I just, I woke up and was like, no, nothing is happening today. I'm just going to sleep. And I did. I slept. I slept all day Sunday, all night Sunday night. And then kind of got up Monday and went through the motions. I don't know. I'm not going to take you through a play-by-play of my illness. Just, I had the flu. That's what happened this week. I'm better now. I feel good about it. My immune system works. So it was very nice to talk with Peter Stenson. We did this over the transom. He lives in Colorado, my former home state, and his book has gotten about as good of a reception critically as one could hope to have. This is a cult novel. 37 is the title. It is a horror novel, cult novel. It's literary, but it's genre. But it's literary. Did I just say genre? I don't know how to pronounce anything anymore. And you know what I'm saying. It's kind of a hybrid. Everybody loves it. And he was kind enough to spend an hour talking to me. Very pleased to feature this one in the book club this month. Here we go. Let's do it. This is Peter Stenson, and his novel, One More Time, is called 37.
I want to know basically the steps and process that someone becomes broken and what they do about it to try to get out of that. And so I think that would be kind of the literary side for me. As far as the horror, I mean, I just like making these anxieties and these fears and these terrors that I feel, and I think a lot of us do, I like, you know, giving them life and trying to make them a little bit more concrete and try to put those fears on someone else by creating stories where they become real for people.
Yeah, get it off of you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but you've never been a part of a cult?
No, not to my knowledge. I've long been obsessed with cults, and a lot of that credit does go to my wife, who, you know, we've been together since we were kids, pretty much, like 19. And I mean, she just devours like all cult related media and activity and literature. So when I was kind of stuck about what to write, you know, I was like, what should I do? She's like, a cult. So this one kind of goes out to her.
So did you watch, like, because I've watched like the Wild Wild Country documentary, which was, I think, like one of the big cult events of last year, if you like cult entertainment. But then I also watched this old documentary from CNN called Holy Hell. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but I try to push that on everyone because it's so fucking bizarre.
You know, I haven't seen Holy Hell, and the Wild Wild Country, everyone loved it. I just couldn't quite get into it. I don't know why. It could be because I'd been a little bit culted out at that point, just with researching and, you know, writing 37. But, you know, I'm a big fan of the classics and the, you know, the canon as far as Heaven's Gate and Waco and, you know, some of those more well-known ones that were going on when I was a kid, and I was just like terrified watching them on TV and so curious. And I don't know. I grew up in a pretty religious household where my mom was, you know, involved in the church and worked there. And so it was like extra taboo, these cults. And I just loved them. And I loved the Nikes they wore and whichever one that was, the Heaven's Gate and stuff. I just, yeah.
So, okay. So what, you grew up where?
Grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota, or just north of there. And yeah, you know, it's like Midwestern nice or Minnesota nice. And
my wife is from Minnetonka.
Okay, nice. Yeah, that's about a half hour away from where I was. And yeah, I mean, it was just, the whole thing is so taboo, but like, you know, we would still watch them on TV and talk about them. And I don't know. I something has always drawn me to the concept of just like abandoning yourself to something larger than yourself and just like being taken care of and actually believing in something. And, you know, I think a lot of ways it's what my parents found in organized religion. And
what church?
Presbyterian.
Oh, that's like pretty low key. I mean, that's not
pretty
like
low key. Yeah. It's not, yeah. No speaking in tongues, and it's all pretty domesticated and barbless. But yeah, there was always that draw, you know, ever since I was little, to just like a group of people you dedicate your life to.
But you couldn't find that in Presbyterianism.
No, it was not my jam so much. You know, I spent a lot of, like, we would always get picked up from school. My mom would have to go to the church and work and stuff. And we would just like roam around the church and the bomb shelters from, you know, World War II or whenever it was. And there was a pool table, so we'd play pool. And I don't know. It's just weird things.
It smelled weird.
And yeah. Then we started smoking cigarettes and we would do that down there. And yeah, it was strange, but not exactly. It didn't scratch the same itch, you know, as far as my fascination with cults and whatnot.
But and that, like, the fascination with cults was like all the way back to childhood.
I think so. Not as strong as like my wife, who, I mean, has read like Helter Skelter like 10 times. But the draw was definitely there. And, you know, I've had some, I think the closest kind of cult-like experience that I've had is just my issues, you know, with addiction and alcoholism and things like that. And just being plucked from one situation and being put into, you know, a treatment facility or, you know, a rehab or a retreat or something like that, and being forced to kind of, you know, like, these are your people for the next 30 or 90 days or however long it is. And you got to figure out how to get by with them and develop close bonds. And it happens in like a really short amount of time in my experience. So I think as far as personal things I was drawing from, it was definitely that experience of going to some place completely kind of broken, and finding that family of your own choosing, those people in there with you, like, you know, you get closer to them and share things with them, then, you know, in a week, then you have people your entire life who don't know certain things about you.
Isn't it interesting how it's sometimes easier to be intimate with like people you barely know than it is to do it with people who are in your family?
I know, it's so bizarre, but so true. Yeah. I mean, I would open up with strangers, you know, as long as we're kind of dealing with the same affliction, way, you know, with complete strangers in 2 minutes, but like with my parents or something, I would never venture forth half the stuff.
Well, but it makes sense to me that you would write a cult, like that would be like a decent preparation for, having some understanding of the dynamics between people in a really intense social structure, like a cult. Like, this isn't to say that like rehab is necessarily a cult, but, I don't know. There does seem to be some crossover, maybe just in terms of like the intensity of the thing and the brokenness. Cause people who wind up being drawn to cults tend to be nursing a wound, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think the parallels are, I mean, they're not just surface level. It's a pretty direct comparison. Just the cults, you know, or like the groups, the support groups that I ended up finding were kind of niche and, you know, about substances and things like that. But underneath, you know, kind of 12 steps and all of that, like, I think the same questions and urges are there of like trying to find meaning and trying to find something authentic and trying to figure out why the hell we are the way we are and, you know, dealing with past trauma and, you know, all those types of things that I think you would turn to, toward a cult for, you know, you're dealing with in rehabs or meetings or therapy and things like that.
Well, I have friends who have struggled with addiction and who've gotten sober, who have done the steps and gone to meetings and they swear by that and it works for them. And then I have friends who are sober who are like, it's a Christian cult, I'm not into it. Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of hear, it sort of runs the gamut. And then I was doing book research of my own years ago. I thought one of my characters was going to be in AA. So I was like, I should go to one of these meetings. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of blown away by it. Like just the rawness of the experience and what people were sharing and just the shit that people have been through. And I don't know. There's some power to it. I guess it's whatever works for you and helps you stay well.
Right. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I am involved in certain, you know, 12-step groups. I try not to talk about it like tons as far as giving those actual names just for anonymity's sake. But yeah, I mean, I have found tremendous help in those groups for years and years and years. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people, you know, if you look at the steps, there's a lot of mention or a couple mentions of God or a power of, you know, higher power of your understanding. And I think that trips up a lot of people because a lot of people are had bad experiences in the church or, you know, different domineering type godfather figures. And that can really be off-putting to a number of people.
So what about you? Like, how did you make peace with it? If you're not into Presbyterianism, like, did you find like a sweet spot where you could be comfortable?
I'd say it's kind of constantly in flux. I think you know, sometimes I'm just like, I straight up don't believe in all of this, but I'll kind of fake it till I make it, you know, and just kind of go through the motions and do those things that are asked of me that are more action kind of oriented, you know, just making amends and doing an inventory and things like that. And then other times I do feel that there's maybe like something out there that is, you know, at least some energy or something I can at least strive to be in line with, you know, that will make me a better person. But as far as, you know, that God being anything like a Christian God or a Buddhist God, or, you know, I don't even, you know, I'm not well versed in other religions, but it, I don't think it really aligns necessarily to that. And just like, I can admit that like my best thinking and my best actions like ended up with me having a horrible, you know, drug addiction, and nothing I could do could stop that. But once, you know, I started listening to other people and trying to be a better person, you know, good things started to happen. So,
well, it's just like humility. Like, I don't fucking know. Like, I have no idea what this reality is.
Right.
You know, and I think it's a little bit, outrageous to think you have it all nailed down. And I guess that would apply to people who are super certain and dogmatic about their religion or their anti-religion. I think like just some sort of like shrug, some sort of cosmic shrug. Like, I'm not entirely sure, but I have a hunch that there's a lot more than meets the eye. And, like, can't that be enough? Like, can't that be like the pointing towards some higher power or connective energy or oversoul or something?
Right. And I agree with that 100%. Like, anyone who is really adamant and, you know, champions their beliefs, it just turns me off, and I shut down automatically, because I'm like, the best minds in our history can't figure this out. Like, why would why would you, Mr.
Falwell,
America great? Yeah, like, yeah. Why is your God the right one?
Well, but what
or vice versa, like, you know, if I'm saying there's absolutely no God, like, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Shit, yeah. Exactly. There are two sides of the same coin. And I have to say, too, having been to a meeting and like watched, like, one of the things I admire so much about it is that it is like, say what you will about it, there's a lot of authenticity. Like, people, mm-hmm. people are getting up there and testifying.
Right.
In a way that like satisfied some desire I had as a kid in Catholic church services, like bored to tears and like confused and like just not connecting, you know, and feeling kind of like bad about myself. Like, why is everybody getting this but me?
Right.
You know, and then eventually it was like I sort of got proud of myself for not getting it. And maybe I overcorrected, but I guess what I'm saying is that I wish there were more of what you might see in a meeting in your average church service, where just people just like take turns taking the microphone, talking about their struggles.
Right. No. And I mean, you laugh, but I think it's absolutely, you know, hit the nail on the head. Like, I connect through people's troubles and vulnerabilities and their fuck ups. Like, that's what makes me human. That's what makes me like them. That's what makes me see myself in them. And, you know, creates a moment of empathy for, you know, 5 seconds when they're sharing. And I think so often, like, those are, we hide those, I hide those, and, you know, go about my life trying to present this better self, when in reality, I'm just terrified and ashamed and, you know, scared of every interaction I have. But through sharing that, you know, I think you can bridge that disconnect between one another for at least a moment. And, you know, I think that's what draws me to writing the kind of stories I do. Just showing that moment when someone is absolutely at their wit's end and doesn't know what to do and takes some sort of action. And, you know, it's usually the wrong action, but tries to find that connection to some other people or some other idea or some other, you know, higher power. But yeah, just really quite interested in that.
So when did you, you said you were smoking cigarettes in the church basement. So I'm imagining you started in with substances as a teenager, like most people.
Yeah, it was pretty young. I like the summer between, I guess, fourth and fifth grade.
Oh, Jesus.
So it was pretty young. I think you're like 10 or 11. And I don't know. There used to be this like video rental store, like VHS in Parrot Video. We used to go there and be able to like take one movie on the weekend, you know, on like a Friday. And I rented Basketball Diaries because I thought it was about basketball. And I watched it and I just like fell in love with it. Like, I mean, I was like, oh my God, like, I love this story. I love this actor. You know, it was Leonardo DiCaprio. I didn't know who he was at the time. You know, I was young and I don't know. Like, I absolutely, something about that really excited me and related in some way. And I'd never touched a substance. But that definitely got the idea in my head. And so I saved up my lawn mowing money and my brother and I bought 1/2 ounce of weed that summer. And, you know, the rest is kind of history. Like, he smoked and he was like, you know, I don't like that at all. And I did. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is what I've been looking for. And yeah.
Wow. Isn't it funny? Because like Basketball Diaries is not a pretty story. It's like,
no.
a story about a guy who like destroys his life. You're like, that's for me. There we go.
It really was like, like the desperation and I don't know, just like the hustle and the grit and the darkness. And it was like what I wanted my story to be. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but that's just how I felt. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think there's something about the age and like, you know, rites of passage and young men wanting to have some sort of like intense experience. I don't know. I had some of that, you know. I didn't have the addiction gene, but I definitely went through a period where I would have done just about anything, you know.
Right.
I wanted intensity of experience.
Right. Yeah. And I like that phrase, intensity of experience. Like, I grew up in a, you know, a nice suburb, nice house. Didn't really want for much. Everything was pretty easy. So I did find myself looking for that, like you say.
So, okay. So you get out of high school. Like, I want to say I was reading and you, like, at some point you were like in San Francisco at a Phish concert. You were talking about this in an interview. And it actually, I think, kind of maybe figures in a little bit to this book, but definitely figures into your first book, Fiend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so things weren't going all that well. And, you know, I'd been like arrested and I think I'd been to treatment a couple times by senior year. And I kind of ran away with my girlfriend. And it wasn't even Phish because they were on hiatus. It was String Cheese Incident, which makes it even sadder. And like, you know, like, but yeah, I ended up there and like, it was just like a really, really bad scene.
Where were you like exactly?
I don't know. I was with some theater there. It was close to Mission Street, because that's where I learned how to, like, you know, get dope and shoot it from some bum there.
Probably like the Warfield.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I guess I could look it up, and it was String Cheese Incident, probably 2001, 2002, something like that. I don't know. There was an Econo Lodge that we were staying in, and I got locked out, and I punched a hole through the window and crawled in and like cut my soul out with a piece of glass and then watched this weird show about Jesus. And
what do you mean you cut your soul out?
I took a piece of glass and I like stripped down and I just on my stomach, I just cut like a big cut. Like, it still has, you know, I still have the scar 20 years later or however long later, 15 years. And I like watched it like drift away. I was nuts. Like,
what were you on?
At that moment, like nothing. Like, it was just, I mean, I was taking a whole lot of ecstasy, like, you know, grams of it a night, which would be like 10, you know, hits of Molly. And I was just lost it. Like, I remember I had one of these disposable cameras, like when I first got there, and I thought like crows were my like spirit animal or something. I had read somewhere, heard. And so they were watching out, and we were down, you know, at some parking lot, and there were just crows everywhere, all over the car. So I was taking pictures, and that girlfriend, like, you know, 6 months later, I was in treatment, sent me the developed pictures, and like, here's your crows, and there were two pigeons on top of a car. So I was just like, and that wasn't like on an active drug. It was just like, it was just some sort of psychosis going on, you know, drug induced for sure. But I was not well. I think that ended with my girlfriend calling and my parents in Minnesota and be like, Peter needs help. He's lost it. And I remember my dad just showing up and like in the middle of the night in some hotel, and I was naked and I didn't even think anything of it. I just went back to bed, and I remember him just kind of like sitting there in a chair, like crying. It was awful.
Was that the bottom? I mean,
that was more or less the bottom. Yeah. I mean, that was as bad as it got. And there was a nice stint of sobriety for a long time, a short relapse, and then sober from that point on. But that was...
How long you been sober?
Going on 14 years.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, thank you.
I used to go to Dead shows back in the day, and especially in those late years, like there is always... And I went to college in Boulder. I lived in Colorado for 8 years. So I know that milieu pretty well, and it can actually get kind of rough. Like a lot of those kids on tour are pretty strung out. Not all of them are kids either. There's some people who've been on tour for that's their life.
Right. Yeah. There's that dark side for sure. And it is kind of like those tour kids who it's not just a couple concerts here and there. It's, this is what we have to do. We probably aren't going to actually see the shows, and this is how we have to support our habits. And yeah.
Were you on tour for a long time, or was that just like one show? You're like, I'm just going to go to San Francisco on a lark. And
I wasn't really on tour. I mean, I was still in high school. I would go, you know, for little runs when I could, you know, like in the Midwest, Deer Creek, Alpine Valley, things like that. So, you know, I'd maybe seen the String Cheese like 30 or 40 shows, you know, 20 or 30, I think, probably. And Fish way less, because by the time I was really into them, Trey had his own addiction issues and was dealing with those. So,
well, thank God he pulled himself out. I think he was going to go down the tubes the way that too many people have.
Right, right. I just read just a couple of weeks ago an article, Rolling Stone or GQ or something, with like 6 or 7 sober musicians, and he was one of them. And it was pretty cool. It was just, yeah.
Well, like it's like the narrative was, it's like following kind of like a predictable course, and then he took a turn, you know?
Right, right.
So good for him. I'm curious to know, like in the midst of all this, like where writing and books figured in. Like, I can't imagine when you were in the depths of your struggle, you were doing too much reading, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're definitely not wrong. I wasn't a huge reader growing up. I liked to write a fair amount. And would always have these grand ideas for novels and get like 10 pages in and then, you know, not touch it again. But all of like the addiction stuff happened in a pretty condensed period of time, from like, you know, as bad from like 15 or 16 till 18. Like it was really just Fast and Furious, Tokyo Drift. Sorry, I don't. Fast and Furious. I had to say Tokyo Drift. But yeah, just
one of the most harrowing addiction movies of all time.
But and then yeah, once you know, I started getting sober, it was like back on, and I would read a lot and write a lot, and you know, and then if I relapsed, then I would stop, and you know, kind of that process. And I wrote one novel on a laptop I ended up pawning for like $10, which is a bummer. I mean, the novel was horrible. It was my first one when I was like 17, but I'd be curious to see it.
What was it about?
Like me, like pretty much. I think at certain points I accidentally like would make like the narrator's name Peter, and you know, it was awful, but It got weird too, because I had just seen Kill Bill, so like the last third is like all of a sudden there's like these ninjas and stuff like that. It doesn't really make tons of sense.
Like thousands of crows. What about, because I feel like you have a particular gift for taking the stuff of your life and the stuff of real life and synthesizing it into these like horror fictions. And by that, I'll give you an example. Like, I think there's a kind of genius to this idea of writing in your first book, Fiend, like it's like a zombie story, but it's tied to methamphetamine use.
Right.
You know, which when somebody says that, like, I'm like, oh, that's genius. That's, you know, like, because there is some kind of zombie quality to people who are cracked out on meth. But
right.
How did that come to be? And then cults and, you know, addiction and religion and, you know, you're synthesizing all this stuff. So is there a through line from book to book in terms of how you might have like thematic territory that you're interested in covering, but you're not quite sure what the way in is. And then, you know, like you say, your wife says, write about cult, or you think about meth and you watch The Walking Dead, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, can you talk a little bit about the creative genesis?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there definitely is a through line with, you know, both of them. I remember like in grad school, my advisor, Stephen Schwartz.
Where'd you go to school?
At Colorado State University. So I moved out from Minnesota to Fort Collins and went to school there. Had a pretty darn good experience there for the most part. Although my first workshop was like, my story was really bad and everyone was so mean. I just cried for like days. And Stephen, he was my advisor and he was in that class, would later tell me, he's like, that was the worst story I've ever had submitted for any workshop, and it made me so mad. And he said that like introducing me for a reading, and I was like, thanks, you dick. But but anyway, he would always say, like, given enough page space, you'll write your way into your obsessions. And I found that to be true with really everything I've written, you know, whether it's short story or essay or, you know, novels, both the published ones and ones that are just sitting on my hard drive, that there's certain questions or themes or experiences that I've had and I'm trying to figure out. And, you know, sometimes that works well with the story, sometimes it doesn't. But there are certain obsessions that, yeah, I'm just trying to work out.
And what are those? Can you name them?
I think one, I mean, it sounds so stupid and cliche that I'm just trying to figure out like if there is a God, or like what it means to believe, what it means to put your faith in something, you know, and then stemming from that is just like, why does any of this matter? And, you know, it sounds so freshman, like, you know, philosophy 101. And I guess it kind of is, but it's what I think about all the time. And it's kind of my natural defense mechanism when I'm being awkward and like waiting to pick up my daughter and talking with the other parents. And they're talking about like Lululemon and school choice and teachers. And I'm just like, I'm just thinking about like cutting my thighs and if there's a reason that we're alive. And that's kind of what I gravitate toward. And so some weird variation of that I find in most of my work, and the search for love and search for acceptance, would be in there too. And I think a lot of my characters are dealing with that and searching for that and, you know, finding different means that supposedly fills that hole for a little bit, whether it's substances or a cult or a belief or a love, and inevitably comes up short every time. So, but as far as kind of the genesis for both books, yeah, you did hit it on the head. Like, I watched Walking Dead and I was like, oh, cool. You know, for Fiend, and I think the parallel there is pretty easy. You know, like if we go back to like the tour discussions and like after the show, like you're walking around the lot, there's like that vacant, soulless look to a lot of those kids. And, you know I've seen that and experienced that. So, you know, imagining those people as zombies is pretty clear. And
the string cheese incident parking lot was it's a magical place of inspiration.
It's just so embarrassing that that's the band. They play mandolin and like.
No, I've been to a couple of those shows. I went to see like Leftover Salmon back in the day.
Yeah, of course.
In fact, I used to see what's the guy? Who's the lead singer of String Cheese Incident? What's his name?
Bill Nershey or Hershey or something.
I don't
know. Michael Kang is the other one.
I used to see one of them like at Whole Foods at like the salad bar. When I lived in Boulder, and I was like, oh, there's the guy from String Cheese Incident. So wait, what is the String Cheese Incident? Is there some sort of origin story where somebody like was tripping and had string cheese or something? And
you know, I don't know that. I don't.
There's got to be a story.
Yeah, there has to be an actual incident, inciting maybe, incident.
Maybe this can be your next book. You're welcome.
Thanks. I'll give you royalties or...
So I want to talk to you about structuring because one of the things 37 has been hailed for is how intricately plotted and structured it is. And I think it's like it's I think it might be easy on the surface for people to understand how you might have all of these different ideas that you feel like fit together in some kind of loose way, you know, religion, cults, addiction, pain, you know, like whatever it is. And It's another thing entirely to build a cohesive narrative out of it and to really keep people turning pages. Like, can you talk about how you do that? Do you do like really detailed outlining? Is this something that you intuit as you go through and you edit a million times?
Yeah, I think outlines for me just confuse me. Like, I can't think that far ahead from like, you know, a scene or two. With 37, it was like that weird experience where it just completely like took over my mind. You know, I was probably searching for some sort of escape. Like we had a young kid and one on the way. And, you know, as I'm sitting there late at night, like feeding bottles and changing diapers, like it was just I was obsessed with this narrative and trying to figure out how it could all fit together. I ended up taking a stab at it and getting about 150 pages in and realizing, you know, the kind of the past sections of when he was, the narrator was at the cult in the mountains just were completely wrong. So I just erased all of those, you know, didn't save any of them and did those again. I think the most difficult part was kind of like the third narrative, like the footnote section, and I used it almost as like notes to myself at first, you know, trying to keep things, you know, like this actually happened, this didn't, this was in the book, this wasn't, trying to keep those straight, and ended up having the most fun with that section, you know, being able to write in kind of a different voice and being able to, you know, I don't think it's really meta, but it was just commentary on both stories. And I think in a lot of ways that trustworthy kind of footnote, third person voice was the most deceptive in the end. And I had the most fun with that. And that one just kind of came once I was taking out my own placeholders and putting them in, you know, a little bit more deception and world building, I guess, and kind of trying to tie the two narratives together and create that third of being, you know, in the psych ward and, you know, the interactions with the doctor there. But it was it was a mess for, you know, a long time, in my head and on the page, and it was going back and trying to just make things add up and dates and everything. And none of them really were,
What about an ending? Like when you're writing your novels, are you working towards an ending that you can see clearly, or is it something that materializes late in the game?
I'd say for both Fiend and 37, there was kind of a general sense, at least of the emotion that I wanted to kind of, you know, arrive at for both of them. It's, I think, a pretty similar emotion in both novels, actually. But as far as the scene, I really wasn't sure. With Fiend, I ended up, once I sold it, I was asked to rewrite like the final third. So I did that. And so it was a completely different ending and, you know, different interactions and stuff there. With 37, that one, I had a better idea. I knew I kind of wanted, you know, the narrator to contact, to confront James Shepard. So I was kind of working toward that one a little bit more, which helped kind of tie everything together.
Do you consider yourself a horror writer? Like, if you could, you care about labels like that?
I don't know. I don't think so. That's a tough question for me. Almost every book I read is literary. I tend to get bored with a lot of horror. I watch a lot of it on TV and movies and stuff like that. But as far as literature, I don't know. I think it tips its hand too clearly, and I don't care all that much about it, aside from Shirley Jackson. But maybe, I don't know. I'm not super worried about, you know, labels and everything.
Well, I feel like horror, it does sell better than typically than,
right,
than like literary stuff, or it's a, you know, it's not quite as hard of a slog, but
right.
I think like I've had this theory for a while, and I have no idea how valid it is, but it seems like if you're somebody who is writing at least like in the direction of genre, to read heavily in literary fiction would probably be really useful, and vice versa. Like if you're somebody who's writing like the most plotless, like inner navel gazing literary fiction, it might benefit you to read some genre fiction that does give a shit about plot, you know, and like page turning and like structure and like these things that, I think can sometimes get lost in the mix. Like maybe like reading outside of your like particular vector is a good exercise.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. I didn't do it consciously, or don't do it consciously, but yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. And I think I get enough plot just with, you know, the movies, because I do like watching movies a lot, or, you know, binging a TV show. And I think my writing, for better or worse, is probably influenced by that. And,
you know, what are some shows or like movies that you feel like you were really influenced by, particularly like horror stuff or zombie stuff or the darker matter?
No surprise, like Breaking Bad and Walking Dead, like you put those two together and you get Fiend. But pretty much, I mean, just since HBO started putting out good stuff, you know, and I guess it's been like 25 years or 20 years, like Sopranos, you know, just kind of like the classic Sopranos, The Wire, those type of shows more recently. You know, I really like that series Dark on Netflix. Game of Thrones kind of bored me a little bit. The Departure, I liked, or Departure. The one, Departure, I think.
Have you ever written for the screen, or have you ever thought about writing? Like, have you ever been approached to do like graphic novels or comics or anything like that?
I have not, no. I think I would enjoy it. I have one novel where there's like a standalone. It's, you know, kind of like a 4-part narrative. Each person has a different, you know, voice or style. And one character's whole part is just like a standalone screenplay. you know, like regulation length and all that. And I had a lot of fun writing that, just because I do like writing dialogue, and I hate writing settings. So if I can just say, like, a parking lot, you know, that is more fun than describing the parking lot for me. But I just, I don't really know how that whole world works as far as selling screenplays and different agents. And, yeah, so
I don't know. There's only like 10 people, I think, who actually know how it works.
I know. It's, like, it, with Fiend, like, you know, there was a lot of this interest and like all these different production companies. And I was like, oh, sweet. Like, you know, Brad Pitt's going to make the movie, and then like just nothing happens. And then I was just like, you know, it's hard enough selling stuff in like New York or wherever, like in the publishing world. And at least there, like once you sign a contract, it usually gets printed. But in movies, there's like 1,000 different places where it can get caught up. And
yeah, it's just, there's always lots of talk and lots of excitement, and then very little happens. That's the normal story.
Right.
Because there's really only so many people who, you know, especially like actors or whatever, who can actually make a movie happen.
Right.
Otherwise, you've got a big group of people making decisions around a not small sum of money. And that always is a complicating factor.
Yeah. So, yeah, that kind of scared me away from pursuing that. I get enough rejection on short stories and novels. And
I feel like your work lends itself, though. I feel like I think that's going to happen eventually, you know, especially if you keep writing in this general vein. I have to believe that people will catch on, because I feel like there's something cinematic and interesting, and there's a line from popular culture to the work that you're doing, but there's also like a depth of intelligence that elevates it, which we need more of in our popular culture. That's my feeling.
Well, I appreciate that, and I think I would love that to be true, and I think. Yeah, it's funny. We live in Stapleton, which is like a new suburb inside of Denver where the old airport used to be. And one of the moms was like, hey, I chose your book for book club. she says this to my wife, and my wife's like, well, why the hell didn't she invite me to the book club? Because they asked if I could come like talk. But anyway, I went over there, and there's like six women, and, you know, it was very intelligent, great book club. But for the last like half hour, they were just talking about like what actors or actresses would play who, and, you know, and 37. And I think, I don't know, it got me thinking. Like, I was like, that would be really cool. You know, a sort of dream to have that come true. I just, yeah, I don't know how one goes about that, or yeah.
Well, I'm here in Los Angeles. Let me make a couple of phone calls. Have it done by Monday.
Yeah, that's all it is, right? Raise $50 million and
yeah. So let's
sell it to Netflix.
I want to talk. I mean, while we're talking about you know, the business of film, I want to talk a little bit about the business side of writing, and just you know, a lot of my listeners are working on books or want to be working on books at some point, and are trying to figure out how to get the work done in the context of having to make a living and having to sort out schedules and do all that. So, like, you started writing. I'm assuming years ago, and like, you know, were you working day jobs? Were you writing at night? Do you have a set schedule? Like, how do you do it?
So I worked at this travel agency when I was younger. And this was like, kind of like a quote unquote, like sober job where you just put in your time and you don't care. You know, I was like 20 or 21, and I worked there a number of years, and I was so bad at it that my line would never ring, because it was like other travel agents would call us and we would sell like bulk airfare. So I just wrote. So I got in the habit of writing in the morning, you know, trying to get like 2 hours done. And it was nice because I would do it on the clock because I was so bad and no one called. And I've tried to maintain that practice, you know, over the last 15 years. Some days, some years better than others, as far as just getting up, writing in the morning, all through like grad school, the, you know, I'd say from like 2008 till probably 2014, I would probably write like 2 hours every morning. And it was before work or before school. And it was just, you know, I would get up 5 in the morning or whatever it was, 5:30, and leave. Usually coffee shops weren't open yet, so I would just sit there with my computer and write in the car. And just try to get, you know, like 1,000 words done. And a lot of times it was shit. A lot of times, you know, I would just erase it after, but at least I was trying to. And I think that was important for me just because I didn't come to writing as educated as a lot of people as far as, you know, reading histories and everything. So I was trying to figure out my voice and how things work and why and different craft elements. But it's gotten a lot tougher. We have 3 kids who are 5 and under.
Oh my God.
well, they're almost 6'4" and 1", but right now you can make that claim just to shock people.
So that's your next horror novel right there.
I know. It's like ever since I've had kids, I keep reading Ben Marcus's, what is it? Flame Alphabet, where like the kids turn on them. Cause I'm like, oh, this is just a story about raising kids and how horrible they are. So it's a lot more difficult now. And especially last couple of years, I was teaching in a public school here. And like for 2 years, I didn't really write. It was just too hard. I was trying to figure out lesson plans and, you know, like that was like 70 hours a week and then 60, 70. And then just with the kids. And so it was miserable. And as far as not writing, I'm supposed to say, oh, it was like the best time of my life when the kids are born and young, but like, I need to write. Like, it's what makes me happy. It's what makes me feel like I can go about the rest of my day and do whatever shitty job, as long as, you know, I've already put in an hour or two writing.
Well, there's a couple of things that come to mind as I hear you talk about this. Like, one is just the basic importance of showing up at the keyboard or at the page.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just show up. Like, it doesn't have to be good. It could be just a big pile of shit and you could delete it the next day. Or just, you know, it winds up in the hard drive somewhere. And then the other thing that occurs to me is that you don't have to have that much time to get a lot of work done. Like 2 hours is fine. You know,
right.
I think sometimes in the past I've gotten caught up in this mindset where it's like, well, if I don't have, you know, a 6 hour block and, you know, once you have kids, 6 hour blocks, are, it's not happening.
No.
And I mean, even if you don't, you know, even if you don't, to find 6 hours to yourself where you're not having to, fulfill work obligations or obligations to significant others or whatever it is, it's just difficult. You know, the world is not built necessarily to accommodate this unless you're, you know, really like you've really pared your existence down socially and otherwise to make writing the center of it. But it doesn't sound like that's what you've done.
Yeah, no, I think a couple things, like for me, like 2 hours, like generally, if I'm in the middle of like a novel or something, like it equates to about 1,000 words. And, you know, if most of my novels are 60 to 80,000 words, like that, you would crank out a draft in like 4 or 5 months. It doesn't always go like that, but, you know, any faster or any more time would be ridiculous. It's like Stephen King, who, I mean, I admire and love and read a lot of his stuff, but I'm not going to write like 3 books a year. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that's crazy. And any more than that, like I just lose focus. Like I have to stop after like 2 hours and like go do something else and, you know, maybe come back. But I just don't have the attention span, for any more than that, sure.
But I think part of being a skilled writer or a skilled artist of any kind is being attuned to your own energies, because there is a point at which there are diminishing returns. And, you know, to write through that point out of some sort of idea of what discipline looks like can actually be counterproductive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then discouraging. And, you know, I've gotten mad at myself, like, oh, this whole section is horrible, like why did I even write it, blah blah blah. It usually is like the first cup of coffee. Like once that wears off after like 2 hours, it's like I'm done for the day.
So what about the business side of books and getting your work in print? Let's go back to Fiend. You write it and you go out like searching for an agent. Was this something you worked on in your graduate program at Colorado State?
This was something I was kind of doing on the side. I was working at the Colorado Review, which is associated with CSU. So I went to AWP as, one of the people, one of the editors manning the booth there. And a gentleman came by and he's like, oh, I'm an agent. And I said like this super cheesy line that like I don't know where it came from. I was like, well, how about I make you rich or like something like so cheesy like that. And he's like, yeah, okay, here's my card. And at that point, I think I maybe had like the first chapter of Fiend done. And, I pitched him a couple ideas that I was working on. He's like, oh, yeah, that one sounds cool. Like, send it to me when you're done. And I ended up just writing it like really quickly. Like that novel came out in about a month, the first draft. I think a lot of it was a personal story. It was pretty easy for me to tell. And then I was just having fun with the more genre parts and, kind of a classic inverted checkmark of rising action. And, the whole thing was pretty easy. And he's like, wow, like this is way better than I thought it was going to be. He's like, I think we can sell this. So we worked on editing and trying to clean it up. And then, I forget the exact time frame, but, he sent it out to, five or six people and editors, and two or three responded and wanted it. And, there was like a little mini bidding war, and it sold like while I was still in grad school, and it was crazy.
That had to feel good.
Yeah, it definitely did, especially after like... everyone was so mean to my first story.
Like, yeah, suck it, motherfuckers. So what about this agent? Who is your agent?
So that agent was James. My God, why am I blanking on his name?
But it's not the same one that you have now.
Not the same. James McGinnis. And I have switched agents to Jim McCarthy.
He's at Distel, Jane Distel's agency.
Yes.
You want to know something crazy? Like years and years ago, I think I met with him early in my agent search when he was just like a baby agent.
Really?
It's like such a small world. Yeah. Like the office right off of Union Square, I think.
Yeah. That is crazy.
I remember that. And I remember, this is another crazy story, is I remember going into the waiting room there before I met with him, and they had copies of Barack Obama's Dreams for My Father. And this was like, this was like before Barack Obama was a thing.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Cause Jane had been his agent. Before he was, before he was a national figure. So it's just like all these weird little like memories I have of that. But I saw his name and I was like, God, that's so familiar. And then I think I met with him early.
Nice.
Yeah. So he is now your agent. Did he sell 37?
He did. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And, that's been, great experience, working with him. I think I've maybe two or three other novels, some that he's liked and wanted to work on, some that he's like, well, why don't we try something else? But yeah, I've had a great experience with him so far.
And what are you working on now?
I was like 100 or so pages into something that was just feeling too dark and like I'd done it before. So I recently took a break on that. Now I'm working on this weird kind of family, small town, Wisconsin. And he's like, works in manufacturing for little rubber axles for tires. And they go into tough times and kind of pivot to making dildos, like shampoo bottles that work as dildos and vibrators. And it's, you know, a complete departure to anything I've done, but I'm having a lot of fun with it. And we'll
I was not expecting that.
No, I wasn't either. And so we'll see if anything happens there. I generally, like, if I get to, I can get 100 pages of something relatively easy and I feel excited about it. And then this weird thing happens where, like, all of a sudden it's really hard to keep going. And I'm like, this, that steam is gone. And I realize, like, I wrote 100 pages when it should have been a, you know, 15 page short story.
Do you then revise it into a story or no?
No, then it usually just sits there and I'll steal parts of it for a different novel or a different idea, or maybe go back to it if something kind of comes into life and, you know, sparks a different take on it. But yeah, it's almost like, it's like I dread that. Like if I hit 100 pages, I'll be like, oh, I need to crank to 110 because I'm like just worried that now it's just in my head that I'll just quit something.
Well, yeah, but how do you know when, like, I guess you don't have that feeling when something is working and you just keep going.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. But at the same time, I mean, like, in the middle of a novel when you have no idea, like, what you're doing or where it's going, like, it sucks, you know, it's scary. And each scene, you're like, well, that was probably the wrong scene.
And what about this feeling of, because, like, your books are dark, you know, and there's,
yeah,
like they manage to be incredibly dark, but also gripping and like gratifying on a human level. Like, it's like a neat trick to pull. And I guess, like, out of my own curiosity, it's like, how do you do that? How do you, like, this latest one that you sort of abandoned, you're like, this is just too dark. I recognize that, because, like, sometimes, mm-hmm, in my own work, it's not horror, but it's just depressing.
Right.
And I'm like, you know what, that there's just no air, you know, and it's like, it's not going to be a redeeming reading experience for anybody. And that doesn't mean that there can't be darkness in a piece of fiction. Like, obviously there can, but it's like, what's the, how do you pull it off? You know, like, how do you make sure that you're not suffocating people?
You know, I think that's a great question, and one that I really hadn't thought about until people started talking about 37 and how dark it is. And it wasn't like overly dark, but that's crazy because it's super, super dark. But just realizing that, like, not everyone thinks like me. Like, it would, if I have kind of like a character stuck in a rut, nihilist, like, things are going horribly, like, as long as they're still striving or still holding out some sense of hope that things could get better, you know, I think there's some redeeming quality there.
Yeah, like the escape is not completely, like, shut off.
Right.
There is, like, some hope. There's, like, one, like, some glimmer of light around the sealed doorway.
Right. And yeah, this latest one, I just didn't see that happening. It was like each little turn I was making, I'm like, oh, things just got worse for this character. And yeah, we'll see. I think there's something there, but it's just not ready yet, you know?
So what do your religious parents think of your fiction? Do they read it?
They do. They love it. I mean, it's,
they're like, hey, he's not, like, naked in a hotel room on 10 Hits of Molly.
Things are looking up. The one thing, it's weird because, like, my mom, you know, she was working at the church and everything, like I said, but I mean, she is, like, my horror movie influence. Like, she'll text me, like, every horror movie, she'll give it a review and just be like, I mean, she loves it. Like, that's what she does now that she's retired. She just goes to movies like that. And it's kind of bizarre. My dad was a little worried with this one just because the father in it, his kind of claim to fame in 37 is masturbating and, you know, at the doorway while his son sleeps. So he, you know, made sure to tell everyone. He's like, hey, Peter has a new book, but I promise you, I never did that. Like, which I would understand, you know.
Well,
because there's other similarities. Like, he's a big fly fisherman, and the dad's a fly fisherman, and you know, he reads the paper every morning. And so there were enough similarities that he's like, oh my God, people are going to think this.
Well, but you know, I think what occurs to me is that, like, sometimes I think people might write really dark stuff. I guess there's a possibility that you're doing it out of some sense of revenge against parents that you didn't get along with. But I think what's more often the case is that people who are able to be transgressive on the page come from a loving family and feel safe and at liberty to go to these places without fear of losing that. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
no, absolutely. You know, and that would be the case with me for sure. Like, my parents were great and loving and supportive, and yeah. 100%.
It counts for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I'm glad we got to shine a light on this book in the book club this month. And I am going to be interested to read your Great American Dildo novel when it comes out.
I am too. I'm like doing a lot of research, which is messing up my like Amazon search history. It's like kids books and giant dildos. And yeah, no, either way, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I wish you well.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is Peter Stenson right there. His novel is called 37. It is available from Bezank Books. Peter Stenson, 37, the official February pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. You can find Peter on Twitter. His handle is at Peter C. Stenson. Peter Stenson, 37. Go get your copy right now. If you would like to join the Nervous Breakdown Book Club, you can do that at thenervousbreakdown.com. Thank you to Kill Rock Stars and the band Stereo Total for the theme song music, as always. Thank you to Tiger In My Tank for the interstitial music. If you have something to say to me, if you would like to comment on the show or tell me a story, you can send me an email. The address is letters@otherppl.com. letters@otherppl.com. If you like this program, if you binge listen, if you have consumed large quantities of my content and would like to offer some support to the show, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. Don't forget about the Other People app. It's free. The Other People with Brad Listy app. This show has its own official app. It is free. Go get it. It's free. So, yeah, I'm better. I had the flu and I'm better, and I'm very excited about it. I get kind of wobbly emotionally when I'm ill. I don't like it. I'm like a little vulnerable. And I was thinking about that this week when I was in the depths of my illness. I was thinking about this movie, Phantom Thread, the Paul Thomas Anderson movie with Daniel Day-Lewis. Isn't that kind of what that movie is about? I only saw it once, and, you know, it was back when it came out, but you know, it's about, like, this woman. She poisons her husband, and she kind of likes it. She likes it when he's sick and, like, vulnerable. Whereas, like, my wife is, like, the opposite. She's, like, disgusted with me. She's like, ugh, get better. You smell weird, and you're sweating a lot. So, anyway, I'm better. I'm kind of bummed out that I missed the Monster Truck Rally. I wanted to go. I've never been to a Monster Truck Rally. It's on my bucket list. But my wife took the kids. I stayed home and shivered under the covers and slept. All right, that's all. That's it. That's it. Bye.